back with episode 511 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and now I know why Charlie was thinking about doing strange things with Maker's Mark.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm really thrilled that Mark Hamill is coming back to play a character we're all familiar with.
Yes, and all I can say is that this has been quite an interesting, not 13 hours, maybe more than that for this particular week, but I'm not sure exactly how much it amounts to. But whatever the case may be, what has become of this week, we'll just have to find out. Obviously, we are back with another week's worth of news, discussion, episodes, everything. And before we get into any of that, Edmund, why don't you go ahead and give a disclaimer before I lose my track of thought?
Certainly. Our policy around here is to discuss just about anything that might have happened in these episodes, in the news, so you will be horribly spoiled, or in the case of the news, perhaps pleasantly informed. But as always, we've waited a week or so before we do that terrible thing to you.
Indeed, indeed. Well, we are going to start, like I said, with a few news items, and who knows where this is going to lead our conversations, but let's see if I look at the first one here. Edmund, why don't you take this one?
Certainly. This is more news from the 24th Bond film, Spectre, that we'll be seeing the return of a recurring villain from Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace. Jesper Christensen, the actor, has confirmed to the Danish press that he is going to be back for Spectre. So a lot of the speculation about whether Quantum will be folded into Spectre or somehow connected with Mr. White coming back, I'd say that that seems more and more likely. But after Skyfall kind of didn't really mention Quantum, it's nice to see that that whole idea of the overarching criminal organization Bond is battling has made a bigger comeback, and not just in the title.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of like this idea that they are not abandoning what they started with Casino Royale. I mean, that was one of the things that I was a little bit bothered with, very little, but a little bit with Skyfall, was the implication that Quantum and everything else that had been built up would suddenly disappear. And it looks like that's actually being addressed. So that's a good thing as far as I'm concerned, a nice little bit of maintenance of the new continuity, I guess you could say.
Absolutely.
All right, let's see. Well, Gary, you already alluded to this. You might as well go ahead and do the next one.
Yes, Mark Hamill is back. Not on the silver screen, though, on the TV. He's coming back to play the trickster character on Flash. Mark Hamill's basically, not exactly, but reprising his role as the trickster. Once again, they've gone back to the 90s TV series and not had to stretch hard to cast for the new show using the old... credits, because he's coming back, and he played a supervillain, I guess you'd call it, called the Trickster, and this show opens up with him actually being in prison and having to help battle someone who's copycatting his sort of trademark habits. So it's I'm once again still looking forward to seeing Mark Hamill back, since and a little earlier than I expected. And it's a nice surprise. I'm enjoying these little homages, as they've been doing with both you know, Barry's father, John Wesley Shipp, as well as the Tina McGee character that was in the recent episodes. I think they're doing the homages nicely without really a wink of the eye, but just, you know, very respectfully, and I hope they keep it up.
Yeah, it's nice to see that they are not holding back on doing more of the, I guess... plethora of villains between Arrow and the Flash. And on the Flash, they of course can get a little bit more into what you could call comic book type stuff than the tone that was set with Arrow. But I think that's part of the nice thing about the way that the franchise, I guess you could say, the Arrowverse is kind of playing out, is that as they add a show to that, it has its own flavor and tone to it. So that's a nice touch, I think. Let's see here. I'll go ahead and take the next one, since I don't think that this is particularly Gary's favorite topic.
No.
But The Leftovers is coming back, of course, for a season two. It promised to be even more depressive than they were now.
How is that possible?
No, what they're talking about here is that they're actually going to be doing some change-up with the cast and location, which is a bit interesting, since... And apparently they are now straying further and further away from where that book ended when it comes to season two. So both the author of the book, Tom Perretta, and Damon Lindelof are saying that they're going to be going into some new directions. So many of the cast may, from the first season, may not even show up in the second season. Of course, that's because some of them are dead. But in other cases, it's just because they've moved on from the location where all of that drama took place. So I guess Tom, Nora, Laurie, Jill, and Matt are all coming back, but no one else is really safe at this point, which is all very interesting. Really what it means is that even people who read the book and kind of knew some of the backstory that wasn't able to be covered in the series will now be just as lost as the rest of us as far as the pieces that are kind of left off of the screen. Because we did get a few comments here and there during the first season about stuff that was a lot clearer in the book than it was in the TV version, which wasn't necessarily intentional so much as a victim of time. But any thoughts on this, Edmund? Because I know you were the other one who was watching the show.
Well. Yeah, no, I'm intrigued by this implication that they feel like they've mined all the material from the existing book, and since Tom Perretta has not written any follow up, that they are feeling just free to do whatever they want. But the other thing that obviously pops into my mind, since this wasn't perhaps the huge critical darling or hit that they might have been hoping, that it also smacks to me like, you know, yes they might be reducing the cast and location for budget reasons too, so but
I figure they were just sick of walking up and down those hills that would seem to be in every other scene.
That's one way of looking at it, I suppose. Let's see, next one. I'm going to give this one to... Oh, Gary, you have to take this. Come on. It's a follow-up on a previous item, but I think this is right up your alley.
Oh, yes, I've heard about this. I can't get my mind around it, but I'm curious where they're going to go with it. We're talking about the sci-fi developing series with comic book writer David Goyer developing the Krypton Superman origin series. Now, I know what you're saying. You know, he left, he was an infant. How much can he contribute? Obviously, we have, you know, Gotham with Bruce Wayne running around as a preteen or teenager, maybe. And so, you know, we get that, but I can only imagine what they're going to be able to do with a child in diapers. I just can't wait to see. Anyway, I'm going a little too far. Anyway, it's supposed to follow, Superman's grandfather on the planet Krypton, and it sets many years, of course, before the planet blows up. And I'm curious how futuristic they're going to make Krypton. We've seen various versions of Krypton over the years, both in movies, TV series, and in comic books. So I'm curious where they're going to pick to go with, and who they're going to go with. Are they going to go with like a villain and have General Zod or the computer Brainiac be the villain, which are both, you know, Kryptonian based? So I'm very curious. I guess they have more freedom in a sense, because given the characters that they're going to have, I don't feel they're sort of locked into the cycle like Gotham is. So there is a bit of freedom, but again, one of the strengths of Gotham was that people do have all the touchstones of these characters. I can't imagine the average person will be that familiar with many people past Jor-El, you know, Superman, Zod, maybe Ursa or Nod, and then I think it's going to fall off. People aren't going to know Quexel and some of the other things that go up, you know, that are Superman history. So I'm curious what they're going to pick and choose from, and whether or not they'll be able to sort of lock in the audience that Gotham seems to, you know, have been able to do because people are familiar with the characters.
My favorite comment was that someone said, "What is this show going to be titled? Arrested Jor-El a bit?" But I could only hope that it would suddenly be some kind of weird, just completely off the wall type of comedy, dry comedy. But Gary, I'm completely with you. I think what was really telling was that the amount of just, it wasn't even necessarily perplexity on the part of fandom, but almost immediate derision of going in this direction. And that kind of tells me that there aren't a whole lot of people that are looking for this to happen.
Well,
so yeah, I don't know.
Well, I have to say, I mean, I'm a huge Superman fan. I'm really big up there. I'm not quite at the tattoo level, but pretty darn close otherwise. And I would look forward personally to this, but I have a hard sense of it having a wide draw for the average viewer. My only thing that sort of saves me for this show is that Sci-Fi has repeatedly said over the past few months that they are trying to get back into actual, you know, harder science fiction. They're trying to get away from the Saturday night movies and the real cheese and get back a little bit more into science fiction. And if they take that kind of outlook to this show, it might be possible. You definitely have a super sort of a futuristic science, you would assume science-based type of show going on. So I think they could do wonderful science fiction stories with this background premise. And I'm hoping that's where it goes and we don't get to see 12 different colors of kryptonite trot out before it's even supposed to exist.
Oh, but come on. They mined it somewhere, right? Right.
I mean, gold kryptonite, rainbow kryptonite, diamond kryptonite, black kryptonite. That's all fun, I admit. But,
I'm sure that we'll know almost immediately what we're in for.
Yes. Yeah, although, my impression of this whole thing has been that it really runs the risk of running into the same trouble Caprica did, where it's you're doing a prequel that's going a little bit too far back and going back far enough to the point where it's beyond the characters that everybody knows. So, you know, yes, maybe they'll do a wonderful job of introducing everybody to Krypton, but at the same time, it may just be a bunch of people running around that people can't quite relate to.
Well, and I hear you, and that's what I agree as well, that pushing it back to his grandfather seemed a bit of a stretch. If they had stopped at Jor-El, I might have been even, you know, more optimistic, but that concerns me. That concerns me too, that they're, as you said, going back beyond a point where pretty much anybody would know anything going on. So,
yeah, exactly. Well, we are done with the news for this particular episode. We are going to go into our break, and when we come back, we're going to jump into some episodic discussion. These are going to be the top three for the week, so stay tuned. Thank you. All right, and let's see. We are going to start off with... Well, first of all, I have to say that we had a tie for third place. But what I'm going to do is, in this case, we're going to go with the one that had the most votes towards its score, since that kind of represents a more a higher level of consensus of quality. Which is not to say that the other episode was in any way diminished, just that it didn't have as many people voting for it. So there we are. But just to name check that one, coming in, unfortunately, in a tie and dropping to kind of fourth place, kind of, sort of, was Homeland, episode 4, or season 4, episode 10, 13 Hours in Islamabad. And just very quickly, the security breach at the embassy results in far-reaching consequences. And that one came in at a 9.0. So both Edmund and I thought that this was definitely the show hitting, if not the high point for the season, then certainly a high point for the season. I personally thought this was the most like Homeland that the show has been in even the season in ages.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes, but I think that we can then go to our number three show, and all of these shows, obviously, if number four was at 9.0, all of our top three are above 9. These are way up at the top of our list for any given type of episode. So that's really impressive as far as we're concerned. So number three is, Gary, why don't you take this one away? Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.,
yes.
Season 2, and, oh, well, let's run the promo first. I don't want to get ahead of myself. As excited as I am.
I can tell.
A reunion between father and daughter is a moment to cherish.
You're a monster, a murderer, a trail of death wherever you go.
Those are all true.
But this one ignites a war.
You can't stop this!
And propels the team towards their destiny.
We finally get to find out what we become.
Marvel's Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the astonishing winter finale, next Tuesday at 9, 8 central on ABC.
All right, now we can get back on track here.
Okay, thank you, John. We're talking, as you said, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the mid-season finale, season 2, episode 10, What They Become. A volatile confrontation occurs between Coulson's and Whitehall's forces, and as a result, fates are changed forever. Meanwhile, Skye uncovers the surprising secret about her mysterious background.
All right, and as I said, this came in at an average of 9.0, anywhere from an 8.5 to a 9.5, but yeah, wow, this is, I believe, the highest rank of the season. So, Gary, why don't you get us started? What was it that you enjoyed the most about this episode?
I thought they did handle the reveal of Skye's past, and not so much the revelation of her past, but the, and I guess, you know, Edmund guy's already hit the spoiler, so yes. For the revelation and how she got her powers, I thought the whole scene was very well done with that obelisk opening up and doing that sort of pulse out, and you know, that sort of cocoon them for a moment, and then, you know, then they broke out of the cocoon, and we find out Skye had powers. I thought that was really well done. It was, I'd say it was movie quality, honestly, and it was really impressed. I enjoyed the sort of build up in the city, so to speak, with the one agent going from sort of active aggressor to more of a guide to some extent. I liked how Coulson was really in control. And not only in control, but like he wasn't fighting from a point of weakness. I almost want to say like he was on par with Hydra's forces, which was a nice change. They seemed so much the underdog through so much of the season that it was sort of nice to see him have resources and people to call on, and you know, it seemed like they actually had an honest a way to fight back. So that was nice instead of them being, you know, underdog all the time. There were some things I didn't care for, but I'd like to still keep it on the positive for right now. John, you liked this episode a lot by judging by your score, which was a 9.5 personally. What was some of the highlights for you of this episode?
Just the way that they managed to bring all of these plot threads together in such a fandom-pleasing way. It's fairly obvious. I mean, they've come out and said it openly at this point. This is the introduction of the Inhumans to the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and I love the fact that, okay, Skye's true identity as Daisy Johnson is now confirmed. And of course, in the source material, her father is none other than Mr. Hyde, And yep, that's who Kyle MacLachlan was playing, was Cal Zeebo, that supervillain, which makes perfect sense when you think of how he's acted all season long. So they've done a really nice job of putting all that together. Of course, Daisy Johnson is called Quake, and if you see what her powers were like when they emerged, that's exactly what it turned out to be in line with. We see that there are other Inhumans out there. It clearly connects to the Kree, just in the way that the things have panned out from last season into this season. So is this a tell-in? We don't know if it is or not. It may just be an offshoot of the home of the Inhumans. It doesn't really matter at this point. But the nice thing about it is just how S.H.I.E.L.D. felt like it was playing catch-up to the movies. And now it actually feels like S.H.I.E.L.D. is setting things up for the movies, which is a really nice touch. Because I know that Bronstam threw out this theory that, well, if they don't have the ability to call mutants in the in the MCU, because the mutant term is owned by the X-Men franchise, then how are they going to get around that? Well, this is actually a really smart way to do it. So now they can lead into, if Hydra was trying to understand this technology and all of this stuff going on with the obelisk and everything related to that, and they've got Quicksilver and the Scarlet Witch, well, this is an easy way to connect those dots. And not only that, but also keep it all consistent for them to eventually come up with a film about the Inhumans, which they already have on the schedule. But all of that, it would be completely useless if it wasn't for the fact that all season long they've been building right to this. And I commend them for, like you said, being able to pull off what is really a reveal on the level of what you would expect to see almost in, if not a high-budget film, then at least one of the lower-budget films of the MCU, and leaving me anticipating where things go from here. And I just love the scene where Skye doesn't hesitate for a second to drill Ward several times in the side.
Yes.
She hate him.
But just, everything came together, and I felt like this is the show by far that we were looking for. And this was the show delivering, at least in my opinion, on all the promises that it's been making all season long. Edmund, you were kind of between us. Granted, we're all above average in our opinion of this one, but you were a little bit between. Anything you want to add to this?
No, I mean, you guys have covered I think the major points, but one thing I thought what was particularly well done, I mean obviously all of the stuff down in the city and the introduction of the powers, I agree was very well handled, and even if I was getting a few flashbacks to Delenn back in Babylon 5 and Chrysalis,
Well, I will mention, not to throw you too far off, but the more recent comic book depiction of how the Terrigen Mist works,
yes,
is in line with what they showed on the show.
Okay.
So not only is it now, basically, in everything that happened with Skye being Daisy and her father and all of that, and it being involved with S.H.I.E.L.D. is all very closely aligned with a series that came out called Secret Warriors about, I would say, 7 years ago.
Okay.
Roughly. And
about that, yeah.
Yeah, so it all lines up, and what the other point that I was going to make, and I just didn't want to lose it while it was still in my head, is that this implies to me that there is a concerted effort not just to have the comics follow in suit with, say, changing Nick Fury up to align with the movies, but now the comics were kind of aligning to go in the direction that the show was going to go. That they're all working kind of together in order to be cohesive, which is rather impressive considering. But anyway.
And not only that, but historically, that was one of Marvel's big things, where they, all their world was all connected and interacting. So they're continuing that tradition.
Yes. So, sorry, I did not mean to throw you off too far.
No, not at all. And one thing I wanted to mention is that I've particularly appreciated how they've been fiddling with the loyalties and keeping people's actual intentions, particularly on the Hydra side, very fluid. Certainly between Colin McLaughlin's character as the dad and Ward and Whitehall, I think they've done a wonderful job of not making Hydra just this sort of monolithic villainous organization, but throwing in these essentially different, slightly crazed or conniving characters. So you really never quite sure exactly where the loyalties lie, and certainly that applies to Reyna as well, where everything she was doing was basically focused on just getting her to this point and her discovering exactly how special she is. So I think they've done some particularly good work there building up both the actual SHIELD team but their opponents as well, and keeping it interesting and not just neo-Nazi bad guys running around.
Yeah, exactly. That could have gotten one note very quickly, and that's the only thing I don't know is what Reyna is actually going to turn out to be like. There are no possibilities that necessarily come directly to mind, but who knows. We could see a bit if they are going to kind of play in the X-Men sandbox by reclassifying them as Inhumans, as implied, then it could be anybody, really.
Yeah.
Which would be kind of fun for them to mine some of the minor characters from the X-Men in some way, shape, or form. That would be different. But we'll see. We'll see how that all plays out.
One thing I didn't want to mention quick, that I was sort of disappointed that Whitehall got killed. It seemed like they'd been doing a reasonable amount of starting to develop the character, and I was hoping he was going to recur for some time. I'm sort of disappointed that we've lost him.
All I can say is he is kind of... I completely agree with you, but at the same time, I'm also wondering if that's going to stick, because he does have, after all, the enhancements from his experimentation with Sky's mother.
Yes.
So, he is long living after all, so who knows what else that means. I wouldn't count him out just yet, because that's how villains go. Although, you know, it wouldn't... I see the show taking a distinct shift going forward to focus more on the Inhumans. That's what was implied by the end, so I don't know how much they're going to get into anything more with Whitehall anyway, at this point, even if he was around. We'll see. I don't count them out. All right, so we are going to move on from there to our number two show, and that would be Covert Affairs. And here is the promo.
Hello, Mr. Anderson. You are going to die.
Tell me where my friend is.
It doesn't matter where your friend is. Blink will lose your coming.
The longer we wait, the more likely it is they'll kill Augie.
How long do you think you can keep this up?
Blanco, don't do this.
All right, and Edmund, if you don't mind.
Certainly. We are talking about Covert Affairs, Season 5, Episode 14, Transport is Arranged. Annie and McQuaid sneak into Russian territory to find Belenko, while Augie is involved in a confrontation resulting from unanswered questions from his past. I think that's supposed to be.
Yes, I would suppose so. This episode came in at an average of 9.25. I can only imagine. Gary, you didn't catch up with this one. I'm shocked. Annie is so disappointed in you.
Yeah. I was very disappointed in myself as well, unfortunately.
Did you move on to someone else? Is Felicity now your girl? Anyway, I wouldn't be so sure that Annie would react well to that. But we will try not to spoil too much here for you.
Yes.
Other than to say that... I'm guessing that the writers of Covert Affairs have been watching Homeland.
Yes, I think so.
Because, damn, that's exactly what this felt like. I really was wondering if somehow they had switched to a different cable network where things were allowed to get a lot more intense, because this was one damn good episode of Covert Affairs.
You have no idea how it gladdens my heart to hear you say that.
I gave it a 9.5. That should tell you a lot right there. It was about as good an episode of this show as you could possibly hope for, and it didn't even have any of those little nits that you could go into as far as subplots were concerned. I liked some of the people that they brought back for this particular episode. I didn't expect them to come back, but it made sense in the context in which they did. And... yeah, they did not hold back. What would you add to that, Edmund?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, certainly. In terms of the way they brought people back, I mean, I thought kind of similar to with Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., how they were really bringing the different plot threads together from this first half of the season. I think there was a lot of that going on in this episode of Covert Affairs as well, of certain stuff that had cropped up earlier in the season that you might have wondered, well, why the heck did they do that? And then seeing it come to fruition here. Despite him being in a very nasty situation, of course, seeing Augie hold up under it as expected. But as you said, John, I mean, it was some really intense stuff, and was certainly well establishing Belenko as a very formidable opponent to deal with.
Yeah, this was in many ways a lot more credible and unnerving versus what we saw out of Henry. And it kind of makes my point about how Henry became a bit of a caricature mm-hmm. as a villain. This is a very different story, which I'm very happy to see.
Yes.
Let's see then. I really don't want to spoil this one for you, Gary, so we're not going to get much further into it.
I appreciate that.
This is one you deserve to watch on your own in Glorian. The final act is just really very well done. Let's go ahead then and go on to something that, Gary, I think you'll have a lot more opportunity to talk about, and I'm very interested in your thoughts on this one. And it's our number one show for the week. Let's go ahead and get into the promo for The Flash.
The witness says all he saw was a blur.
What did it look like?
Like a man that was looking for something.
I found him, Dad. I found the man who killed Mom. Don't let him take any more.
Catch me.
This man stabbed my mother through the heart. This is my fight.
All right, and Gary, if you don't mind doing the recap.
Absolutely. We're speaking about The Flash, Season 1, Episode 9, The Man in the Yellow Suit. Barry faces his nemesis, Reverse Flash, who killed his mother, and plots with Wells and Cisco to trap him. Meanwhile, Eddie gives Iris a surprising gift at Christmas and leaves her with a question that could change her life. Really? Yeah.
Yeah, and this came in at a total, or an average, of 9.3, so just edging out Covert Affairs. So, yeah, two shows that you enjoy quite a bit there. Gary, right at the top of the list.
Yeah, this show really blew me away. If you know, when they announced The Flash being a series, and if I could have pictured the series, it was this episode. We had our supervillain, very manipulative and taunting of the hero. We had some of the hero's allies who aren't superpowered, but were also drawn into it. His stepfather. Was intimidated by the Reverse Flash to not keep looking into the case. We also have, on the personal front, we have Barry spilling his heart to Iris finally after all these years of being around her. So we get that little bit. We get the part that Iris and Eddie are actually reaching a significant crossroad in their relationship with the taunting tease of the small box, which turned out to be a key rather than a ring. I thought that was a nice little scene, but. Not surprising. So we had that. We even had our super scientific trap to try and catch the Reverse Flash in a force field kind of bubble. We had that. We had this revelation that I can't even quite understand as this sort of teaser, almost like at the last page you'd find on a comic book, of Wells showing a suit that first looks blue and black, which actually is a whole nother Flash, which I'm not sure that I want to touch on for some people yet. But and then you see it changing to the yellow Reverse Flash suit, and then you see him taking that tachyon sort of harness and putting it on the suit, and then Will starts talking in the voice, and then it fades to black. And it left me with so many questions, and then at the same time, it did so much. I forgot to mention the scene of Barry speaking with his father in the prison. And he's talking about how he found the guy that killed his mother. And you look at the acting between those two actors in that scene, especially John Wesley Shipp, you know, talking about how this person has already cost us too much already. Don't let him take any more away from us. It was a heartbreaking, touching scene between, you know, a father and a son. So as I said, you know, supervillain, personal, romantic, tease, ongoing drama, where you're lost of where the show's going to go to next. I just thought it was great, and I could rave about it for a while longer. But I'll let you guys rave, because from our scores, everybody enjoyed this episode.
Yeah, Edmund, why don't you jump in on this one first?
Sure. I thought this was an amazing case. I think it's kind of a thread throughout these top shows where we've got all these shows kind of coming up to what they now call the fall finale or the mid-season finale, and I'm thinking just in general that now that this sort of structure has been out for a number of years now, it's like writers are finally catching up to how to really do these seasons in two parts, because this was another case, and in this case of a show that's just in its first season, but really managing to bring all of the plot threads together, bring it to a satisfying climax, but certainly with still huge questions and implications involved, but also a very nice case of taking some of the stuff that might have seemed a little awkward and problematic, especially I think in the case of Virus and the way those character beats between her and Barry and her and Eddie and Barry were playing out, and bringing it to a very nice head. It was great to see a show actually go with the don't keep hiding it from her and playing these what have become almost the silly TV trope games, but just come out and tell her and deal with whatever awkwardness occurs. And but one thing that did occur to me was sort of in the way that the Iris character has advanced in the last few episodes. I would love to see it continuing a little bit more, and where now that Barry's made his confession, if she starts combining that with the Flash's behavior towards Eddie in the previous episode, that she may start figuring out some secret identities before anybody has a chance to let her in on the secret, which I think would be interesting development when they come back for the rest of the season.
You're right there. It does seem to me like if it's a little ludicrous that people haven't figured out who Oliver is over on Arrow, that Barry's not that generic looking a guy, that it shouldn't be that obvious when he's, I don't know.
Yeah,
there are times when it seems like it should be fairly obvious for people, but they've been careful before to try to show him, vibrating so that you can't see his face and stuff like that. But at any rate, yeah, it's his earnestness is probably shining through more than anything.
Yes.
The part with Iris may have been the slight difference between me going from a 9 and a little bit higher, because I felt like it was authentic. But the weakness of the Iris character up to this point made it a little bit, it wasn't as smooth a journey to this point as I would have hoped. And I was actually a little bit put off by her lack of reaction. Because one would, yes, I'm sure that it comes as a little bit of a shock to her, but even her facial expression was kind of non-existent. So I don't know if that's the actress or what, but Iris has kind of been, unfortunately for me, one of the kind of weak points of the show. But this was probably her best showing, if only because it was some really good, strong material. This I'm not that well-versed in Flash lore by any means to be able to say what the comic book connections were, versus S.H.I.E.L.D., where I know the Marvel stuff pretty well. But I loved the balance of all the elements here. Even though I was beginning to suspect Wells throughout the episode, I think they left it in a place where I'm not even sure what I'm suspecting him of now.
Yes.
I loved the whole thing where they parse out that now that you've seen both Flash and Reverse Flash, which has to be one of the cornier names ever, but I'm glad that they had the one character give him that name, because he's really good at selling the silly names.
Yes.
Just because of his personality, but that each of them has a different color of their lightning, in that it ties into the moment of his mother's death, because both of them were apparently present.
Mm-hmm.
So that really starts playing into the time travel element of this show a lot, and really makes Wells and his motivations a lot harder to parse out, which is a lot of fun too. So yeah, this was about as this was pretty much like you said, Gary. I think you put it right at the top. What my thought is about this, and that this is pretty much where I wanted the show to be from the start. Just as it took about this many episodes for Arrow to find itself, I think that The Flash has found itself. And yeah, I'm very happy to say, as I was talking about before, the two shows now have such a distinct personality to them, and they're excelling in both. And it makes me feel a little bit more confident in the idea of them possibly bringing another series, Supergirl, into the mix and being able to pull it off, because I think we are all very worried. Are they going to be able to take the Arrowverse and extend it into The Flash and still have it seem cohesive? And I think that they struck the right tone of that comic book universe thing where you can have heroes with drastically different tones to their stories, but it makes sense for them to still be in the same universe. And they've managed to pull that off. I'm really impressed. And The Flash is not the easiest thing to sell people on. You know, it is a little bit corny, but it works in this. The lead actor pulls off the earnestness of the character so well. I really have to give him credit for that, because it's infectious. You want everything to kind of work out for the show. And in this case, at least, this is them really putting their stamp on it, to kind of echo a lot of what you were saying, Gary. But obviously, we all felt that way. This was our top show for the week. Gary, we have a little bit of time here. Do you want to speculate a little bit on what, kind of elaborate on what you were saying about that final scene for the episode? Give us a little bit of insight.
Oh, geez, there's they pack so much into that, it's almost hard to go through it with the time remaining in the show, but I'll do my best. We'll start off in one way. Reverse Flash, at least one version of him, his thought is that he has to prepare Barry for some oncoming crisis. And so only by putting him through adversity will he, like, rise to be the hero that he's supposed to be. So in a lot of ways, I see this as sort of Wells' role, and I'm thinking that that's where they're going with it, that he's trying to actually make things tougher for Flash, make him develop his powers, make him think on his feet, make him become a better hero, because he's going to need to be all these things for some disaster that's going to happen in the future. And that would seem to fit well. The teaser with the costume being a blue costume, though, was someone also from the future, another Flash, who was actually trying to be an assistant to Barry to help him during a incredible crisis that was going to come up, maybe almost like as a partner, not more than a sidekick, but not quite an equal kind of thing. So that's another sort of door they opened as well. So I'm not sure where they're going with it, other than I think that Wells is going to be that character, that reverse Flash, if he does become the person who's trying to make Barry get up to speed, no pun intended, with being a superhero.
Hmm. Okay. That's fair enough. It seems to line up with what we've seen so far out of Wells. Now, is Wells like a completely new name as far as the lore is concerned?
Harrison no, Wells? But as no, he's not. So Wells, as the sort of time traveling, you know, running joke goes, has come up a few times, and the name Harrison is actually more related to that blue costume, if I recall correctly. You know, before he sort of changed the color to yellow, but I'm not sure where it's not an I don't. It was never a literal character until they've, you know, introduced it on this show, that, you know, of that particular character. So it's not a exact pull the way that the way, like, you know, Dinah is on Arrow or something like that. It's not a direct pullover. The only direct pullover name, actually, besides Iris, of course, would be Eddie Thrawn, who also becomes Reverse Flash at one point in the comic books.
Okay.
And a matter of fact, it ends up being a whole time traveling thing where the Thrawns are constantly against the Allens, you know, sort of as perpetual villains, almost in a Hatfield McCoy type of, they're constantly battling each other over the centuries. Their families sort of are, you know, our enemies. So it's interesting to see this Eddie being dangled out there, and who seems like a very honest, conscientious police officer. And yet, you know, in the comic book world, he is the first Reverse Flash. So
it would be really interesting based on that if that does kind of play out in that direction, and what Wells turns out to be is someone who has appropriated the something somehow and is kind of taking on that identity to make things right or something to that effect. But we'll see. It's way early in all of this.
Will Eddie get the suit to go after the Flash the way that they're implying too?
There's a lot of fun stuff there, but it's very much in line with what we saw in terms of the writers playing with established Green Arrow lore, which of course was fairly easy for them to do, considering that writers on Arrow were the same people who wrote the comic for years. Yes. But you know, we have Geoff Johns, of course, is involved with both shows and helps write some of the scripts. I think he might have been involved in this one, but I'm not off the top of my head recalling. But at any rate, he has shown a penchant for finding ways to connect continuity in some fun ways. So, I'm really enjoying the show. I think that it's really good to see this universe kind of fleshing out. So we'll see where it goes from here.
And so ends another epic episode of The Critical Myth. If you want to leave a comment for this show, head over to vognetwork.com. Not only can you find links to the podcast version of each show, but there is a dedicated forum, a ton of written reviews, and related articles by the crew throughout the site. For the written reviews, you can even leave your own review, so let us know if you agree or not. You can also leave comments on our Facebook page, Critical Myth, on Twitter at Critical Myth, or Google Plus under The Critical Myth Show. Any and all use of copyrighted material is only intended for discussion, commentary, parody, or educational purposes, in accordance with U.S. Code Title 17, also known as fair use. In other words, please don't sue us. And of course, the statements and opinions of the Critical Myth crew are not necessarily those of the VOG network, its partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. Until next time. Watch, read, and listen, and believe in the critical myth.